Internet at the speed of light. In the days before the advent of electricity, Americans often questioned why they really needed this new technology in their lives. Now, electricity is seen as a basic right, and we can't imagine life without it. Telecom expert Susan Crawford's latest book makes the case that fiber optic networks are the electricity of today, that it has already been transformative in other countries, and that America needs to embrace a fiber-based internet as essential to our future growth. I'm Cindy Hahn. Author and Harvard Law professor Susan Crawford joins us to explain just what fiber optic connectivity is, what it will enable us to do, and how some communities are being proactive in bringing fiber to their citizens' homes. We'll also learn where Maine stands in the fiber revolution. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. For many of us, the benefits of fiber optic internet connectivity is not top of mind, but our guest today says it should be. In fact, her latest book makes a powerful case for the transformative power of fiber to connect us at higher speeds and greater capacity to each other and to the rest of the world. We'll learn more about that today and also hear about what's happening with fiber technology here in Maine. Joining us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles, Susan Crawford. She is a national expert and advisor in technology and communications. She is the John A. Reilly Clinical Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. And her latest book is Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. As always, we'd like to hear from you. Are you curious what exactly the benefits are of fiber technology? What efforts have been made to improve internet access in your community? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you so much for joining us today, Susan.
Cindy, it's a joy to be here.
So let's start with the basics. I think there are many people who are confused about fiber, including me. what is it? How do you differentiate it from broadband? And how does it relate to 5G? All of that. So you're a professor. You can give us a quick lesson in fiber.
Well, here's the quick idea. Fiber as a technology is not particularly new. It's been around for a few decades now. And our communications between continents and between cities in the United States are already carried by fiber optic cables. These are hair-thin strands of glass that have been very carefully manufactured so that they're so clear, a signal sent by a laser can go through that glass for tens of kilometers without needing to be encouraged or boosted. And that means that once that glass is on the ground, in the ground, you can put different forms of lasers at either end, electronics. And as far as we can tell, the capacity for that very thin strand of glass to carry information is essentially unlimited. So that's why cables going underneath the sea are made of fiber, and cables between towns are in the United States as well. Our huge bottleneck in our country is the very last bit of our communications network, that is between your home or business and the next link up in the internet chain. There's very little fiber in that part of the network. And in rural areas and in places like Maine, very little fiber at all. And what that means is we aren't able in the United States to communicate using large files, which could include our presence, being able to feel present in a meeting at a distance, being able to get a great education for your kids, no matter where you live, being able to get access to world-class healthcare, to have eye contact among family members at a distance. We can't do that reliably in the States because our connections, frankly, are pretty awful. And Maine, unfortunately, ranks among the lowest among the states of the United States in both accessibility and speed of connections. And another huge problem in this whole area is that because there's neither oversight nor real competition in a lot of parts of the country, prices are extremely high. So often people can't afford to pay for a good connection, even where it is available. So bottom line, fiber is the world-class, future-proof, relevant technology for what's called the last mile of the internet access network, but very few people in the United States and fewer still in Maine have access to that kind of connectivity. There are many heroes across the country, more than 800 places where people are taking charge of their own destinies and ensuring that there is fiber there. And there are lots of great stories to tell about Maine. So I'm here to be optimistic and uplifting and
not
tell everybody about this. Yes, absolutely. And tell everybody about this real revolution in connectivity that requires both political will and great energy to make it happen.
Well, great. And we want to hear some of those stories soon. But getting back to those definitions, when you talk about how fiber is almost infinite in its capacity.
Yeah.
How can you place it on a scale when we're talking about broadband? It is a form of broadband, as are cable and satellite, DSL, right? Is there sort of a scale to slow to fast in those
Absolutely.
Categories?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like, you know, in comedy, there's a rule of threes. There are only three wires to think about. And a lot of people in America are relying on copper DSL wires. And you can think of copper as like a 2-inch little stream of water in its capacity to carry information. The middle wire to talk about is the cable company's hybrid fiber coaxial connection, which has greater capacity than that copper wire, but has been architected to very much prefer downloading over upping. And you could think of this, I don't know, a couple feet wide of water in comparison to the 2-inch little crappy DSL connection.
Mm-hmm.
And then fiber, the hero of our story, you can think of as ultimately something like 15 miles wide in its capacity to be full of data. If data is water, that's what we're talking about with fiber, that between you and the rest of the world would be only a pane of glass. If you had an adequate fiber connection in your house, you really would feel present at a meeting, present in a classroom, and present in a doctor's office.
Well, for anyone who's still skeptical and says, what is the big deal about fiber? It might be too much trouble, and we can already get on the internet and do what we need to do. You bring up in the book the example of electricity and how revolutionary that was in its day. So can you elaborate on that, on fiber really reaching the point where we take it for granted, like electricity?
Absolutely. You know, my grandmother used to call the electric bill the light bill. Because in the 10s and 20s of the last century, many poor homes and homes that were just starting to get electricity thought of it as only useful for a single light bulb in their home because we didn't have other appliances. Refrigeration hadn't yet arrived, and we couldn't imagine that anybody would use it for more than that single luxurious light bulb. Rural areas in the United States didn't get electricity until deep into the 20th century. 90% of farmers in the 1930s did not have electricity. And it was viewed as a luxury, not as a utility, completely controlled by a handful of private companies that had essentially divided the country up into parts and were charging whatever they could get away with. Not evil companies, but they saw, you know, short-term profits in selling only to very dense and rich areas and only to businesses initially, and not to residential areas, certainly not to poor residential areas, and not to people in rural areas. It took tremendous political leadership by FDR in the 30s to fight the private electrical interests, who were sort of the Comcast, Charter, AT&T, and Verizon of their day. Electricity was the domestic policy issue of the 1932 presidential campaign, and FDR was nearly blocked from the primary by the private electrical interests because there was so much rhetoric on the private side saying the public sector should not be involved in electricity and it's a luxury. Fast forward to today, we assume that electricity powers everything we do. We assume that when you move into a house, it has to be rated for electricity. Refrigeration is a constant. Productivity requires electricity. It's just part of our lives. It's faded into the background. Similarly, we're sort of at the beginning of this battle when it comes to fiber optic internet access. Internet access in America is still treated like a luxury, extremely expensive, very often available only at very high prices to poor people in urban neighborhoods. And not available or available as a very second-class service in rural areas. And people are just starting to wake up and say, no, this really should be a utility. And as I said, there's so many leaders across the country who are saying we really need to have this basic utility present. And like electricity, the service itself doesn't need to be provided by the government, but the idea of a basic wholesale functioning service has to be overseen by the government and ensured to be available at reasonable prices to everybody who needs it, just for a flourishing, respectable, decent life. This is not about wealth distribution or anything like that. It's just what is basic for America. And fiber, this giant phase change in internet access, should be considered basic for all Americans.
Okay, I wanted to go back to the fiber itself, because you had a great section in your book that was really fun to read, where you described just watching how these fiber optic cables are actually made, and you went to Corning, saw the whole behind the scenes happening. Can you kind of describe that process for us?
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed that. That was me trying to be the John McPhee of fiber. And it was a joy to see it being made. It's extraordinary. So the thing to understand is that every micron of this slender strand of glass is precisely manufactured, starting with essentially having soot from flames deposited in very carefully governed layers, thousands of layers, where the recipe for each layer is slightly tweaked. The mind boggles, it really does, to eventually essentially print a thick plug of glass, which is then melted very, very carefully, again, with every element of that melting process completely controlled and drawn. A glob of glass is drawn in a thin strand down five stories of the Corning Manufacturing Center.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And then that glass is the thing that allows these essentially unlimited signals to be carried. So I gave a copy of the book to my dry cleaner in New York City in Greenwich Village, who's been having real trouble getting an adequate connection for his small business right there, right in the middle of Manhattan. He read about fiber and he looked at me, his eyes were blazing, and he said, "This is amazing." And it is.
It's quite an invention. How does it go then from those fiber cables that are made to being physically installed, as you said, the last mile that reaches someone's home?
Well, that's
it's underground,
the expensive part.
Correct?
Yeah. Well, it can be done underground or on poles. There's a very operatic story about pole access in the United States. Turns out that telecom is full of humor and drama. And those poles are often owned by incumbent companies like AT&T and Verizon, or utilities that aren't anxious to cooperate. And often the weather doesn't help. Putting things on poles might not be a smart idea. So often the more dependable and predictable way to install fiber is to actually dig up streets and install a conduit into which those very thin strands are laid. And I watched this being done. I tried to describe it in the book. It's thrilling. Because once you cover over that trench with cement, you've said goodbye to that fiber for the next 50 years. Because unless somebody cuts across it by accident, it's impervious to rain, it won't be interfered with by electricity. It's really a very resilient technology, and you draw that fiber all the way up to the side of a house, or at least to a neighborhood, and then that essentially unlimited communications capacity is there to stay.
And that's one of the appeals of this format, is the 40, 50-year lifespan of a fiber cable. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. People use the phrase future-proof, and I think that's right. Certainly for this next generation, it is the world standard for communications. People often say, well, wait, we've got wireless. Why do we need wires? And that's like saying, well, we've got airports. We've got airplanes. Why do we need airports? Mm-hmm. Or we've got off-ramps. Why do we need freeways? That 95% of any connection to the internet that you're making wirelessly is actually a wire. Those wireless communications have to be dumped onto something in order to travel to the rest of the internet. So getting fiber very deep into rural areas, neighborhoods, everywhere is essential for very high capacity wireless connections to also exist. So in very rural parts of Sweden, for example, and in South Korea, they have extraordinarily high quality wireless connections that never drop because there's fiber everywhere.
And that is a huge point in your book, that the United States is way behind many of the other countries in Asia, Northern Europe, where everyone has fiber optic connectivity, and it basically lets them live these much more advanced lives than we do here. What does life with fiber optic connectivity look like in a place like South Korea or Sweden?
Well, I'm also interested in something that has been revealed since I finished writing the book about a year ago, which is that China is planning to have 80% of their homes wired to fiber optic to create their giant middle class and their market for products. And what life is like, people in South Korea, for example, assume that everything just works. They assume that whatever they need to do, whenever they need to do it, they'll be able to do it using a connection. They'll be able to be present in a meeting, you know, go see a doctor, get educational assets to them. As a society, here's my big differentiator in the book between South Korea and America. I would never count out South Korea. They have raised themselves from rubble. But as an entrepreneurial group, they're not as risk-taking, not as scrappy as the United States. So I anticipate that the great developments in use of this extraordinary capacity will come from a place like the United States once we get this straight. The really transformative killer applications for this will be developed here, but they'll only be developed here if we have this connectivity in place. Without it, we won't be the sandbox where new ways of making a living, you know, new ways of new industries even appear. China, unfortunately, really has figured this out, and it's not just within their geographic limits that they're putting in fiber. The giant Belt Road Initiative, which is planned to cover 80 plus countries with infrastructure and 65% of the world's population, that's a strategic and military initiative of China that will be accompanied with fiber plus very advanced wireless. And that will give that empire, perhaps, control over the entire supply chain of information services, everything from data transport to the insight, the analytics, the artificial intelligence that is applied to that data. So this should be a Sputnik moment for the entire United States, and it is for local officials. I spoke yesterday to the National League of Cities, and many, many, many mayors are really interested in this area and are looking to make progress.
And the question is whether our federal government is going to react to that sort of, not really threat, but competition.
Yeah, well, here's a place where the main story has really been inspired by federal activity. The 2009 Recovery Act stimulus bill included money for high-speed internet access. And Maine, under the very skillful and humble leadership of a guy named Jeff Letourneau, who's at the University of Maine, applied for a $25 million grant from that stimulus funding, which went into building what's called the three-ring binder in Maine. It's a fiber ring that reaches deep into rural western and eastern and northern Maine. And that federal help, that money, has encouraged a lot of other fiber developments around the state. Now, that happened under the Obama administration, and full disclosure, I was there. I was there in the beginning of the Obama administration working on that stimulus grant program, although not personally involved in any grant giving. A future administration could do a lot more of that. We're on pause at the moment because our current federal administration is not interested in seeing fiber as essential infrastructure for every corner of the country, and certainly not competitive, open, basically public fiber that, like the three-ring binder, that anybody can take advantage of in order to sell retail services.
Okay, and we'll have a chance to talk more about the three-ring binder in a little bit, but we'll take a quick break now, and when we come back, your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be back in a moment.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Houston & Company, celebrating over 30 years of fine furniture making. Showroom and workshop in Kennebunkport, and online at houstonandcompany.com.
On the next Fresh Air, why are emergency room visits so expensive? $60 for ibuprofen? And why are the costs so unpredictable? We talk with Sarah Cliff, a health policy journalist for Vox, who collected ER bills from around the country and then got the stories behind the bills. Stories of hidden fees, high deductibles, out-of-network doctors, and more. Join us.
That's tonight at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know if you don't have cable, it is still possible to see Maine Public Television, all four channels, The World, Create, and Kids as well. In many areas of Maine, you can watch all four of our television signals with an HD TV antenna. Will that work in your neighborhood? We have created a resource to help you answer that question, including finding out the likely signal strength where you live. Go to mainepublic.org for more information, click on Television and Guide for Watching Over the Air, or give us a call at 1-800-884-1717, and we'll send the information right away. With or without cable, Maine Public Television brings you four channels of the highest quality programming, an educational resource not to be missed.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, how fiber technology works and what it takes to make it a reality here in Maine and nationwide. Joining me today, Susan Crawford. She's a Harvard Law School professor, national telecom expert, and the author of the new book, Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. We invite you to join the conversation. You can call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post a comment to our Facebook page. And joining us on the line now is Rob Souza. He is president and CEO of the telecommunications firm Otelco. Thanks for joining us, Rob.
Thanks for having me today, Cindy. Glad to be on the program.
So tell us a little bit about Otelco and what you do to bring broadband to, especially to the rural parts of Maine.
Sure. Otelco is a small publicly traded firm, and we operate a number of companies in the state of Maine. Many of the areas that we serve are those rural communities that were left out of receiving telecommunication services in the early 1900s. And your guest, Susan, mentioned the fact that the government got involved in the electrification of America. They also got involved in making sure that everyone had access to telephone service. Rural Electrification Administration became the Rural Utility Service, and we participated in that back in probably the 60s and 70s, bringing telephone service to parts of rural Maine. Today, we're involved in bringing fiber optic cable and broadband services to those same communities. We participate with the FCC in one of their programs called the Alternative Connect America Modeling Program, where we receive funding, and in return for that funding, we have to bring broadband to these rural locations. And we are doing that not only this year, but over the next few years, we will be bringing broadband to over 2,000 locations in Maine via fiber optic facilities.
And how can someone find out more if they're interested in getting fiber connectivity to their home or their business?
Well, in our case, folks could certainly visit our website, otelco.com. That's OTELCO.com. And on that website, they can put in their location and verify whether, one, we are a service provider in that area, and the second thing they can discover is whether fiber optic facilities are available where they live.
Okay, well, great, Rob. Thanks so much for calling in. Rob Souza is president and CEO of Otelco. And we have another call from someone right now. This is Kairam Durda. He is chief operating officer of GWI, an internet service provider based in Biddeford. Kairam, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So we were talking earlier a little bit about the three-ring binder. Maybe you can tell us more about what exactly that is and how it works here.
Well, the three-ring binder is similar to the artery system one has in their body. That is, it connects, it's called a middle-mile network, where it's essentially like the interstate highway. And in Maine, there are three significant portions of it, which is why it's called the three rings. The first ring is called, it goes from Biddeford all the way to Farmington, all the way down to Bangor. Then there is the northern ring, which is essentially north of Millinocket, all the way up to Fort Kent. And then there's the Downeast Ring, which is in the Downeast area. So it goes all the way to Machias and then cuts over again to Millinocket. So it is essentially the interstate highway that allows internet service providers and everybody else to bring their services on top of that. So it doesn't go all the way to the house. It doesn't go all the way to the business. It is essentially the interstate highway.
Then what does GWI do to help overcome that last mile issue and actually bring the fiber right to someone's home?
So we work a lot with the communities. We are a maniacal believer in open access. That is, internet is a right. It should be accessed by all. Mainers need to have a choice. We are very progressive in our beliefs in net neutrality and data privacy. So in terms of bringing it to the last mile to the premise, we have some very honest conversations with the communities, because there's about three distinct ways you can bring and solve the middle mile problem. One is just the private money, which works in the larger, denser metro areas. Then there's the public-private partnerships, which have various different flavors that work in population centers, say, from about 5,000 people and up to like 15,000 people. And then there are areas where we believe that as part of the social contract, the taxpayer needs to be able to figure out a way to subsidize getting to those last mile. I mean, there are places in Maine, God bless, because we're rural, it is not very dense, but society as a large, as part of the social contract, needs to make those decisions. So together with the communities, we look at federal funding, state funding, our own money, working with the community to see what we can unlock from them. The bedrock principle is open access for us. The network needs to be able to have competition. So even if we build it, we will allow competitors to come on it. We'd have absolutely no problem with local ownership or the municipalities owning it, but we request that it be open access, that everybody should compete on it, because that's how you grow the economy. That's how you become part of the 21st century.
Okay, so great, Carol.
There is no one answer to do that.
Right, but, and in fact, that I know that Susan Crawford wrote a lot about that as well. So thanks so much for sharing that information. That was Karim Durda. He is Chief Operating Officer of Internet Service Provider GWI. And Susan, you did describe many instances of community efforts that have been successful in getting that last mile to their residents. Did you want to share any of your favorite success stories there?
Well, there are so many scrappy cities across the country working on fiber networks, and understanding that this is not just about availability, as Otelco is talking about, but also price. And GWI having this model of ensuring that there's competition across their network is propelling competition, because there might be two providers providing retail services that are cheap. I have found many really heart-stirring stories of communities seeing this as a utility and caring about price, not just availability. So, for example, in Wilson, North Carolina, there's a terrific publicly controlled fiber network there that is available to people in public housing in Wilson, which is a small, struggling town in eastern North Carolina, for just $10 on top of their rent bill. And a single mom in one of those public housing units in Wilson told me that getting that fiber access into her unit for $10 a month was the most important thing that had ever happened to her family, because her boys could actually do their homework from home. And because she has no access to transit, she can't get them to the library. There's no way to do that. And this way, her kids are getting great grades, and she can watch them doing the homework. And it's just part of their lives. They're part of the 21st century. So Wilson, as a plucky story, is one of the very, very best. And they have dedicated fiber strands going to each part of their city, not based on demand, not based on people saying, I'll pay X or Y for it, but just treating it as a utility. We don't expect a bridge to make an enormous profit. We just expect it to provide spillover effects, greater economic success for an entire area. So when people say we can't get fiber that's public to a very remote area, because it doesn't work, in quotes, what they're saying is they don't think that the economic model would make sense for a private company that's expecting very quick, very high returns. It does make sense for the public sector to do this, because of the benefits for the entire society that are created when we all have electricity, we all have modern communications, we all have clean water. That's what this is about.
Right. As you said, the mindset of thinking of it as a utility is all the difference. Well, we have some, I think, plucky stories here in Maine. I'm going to go to a call now. We have Jay calling from Old Orchard Beach. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Well, good afternoon. How are you?
Fine. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I worked in the industry for about 20 years and worked for Bell Atlantic and Verizon and Fairpoint there, and sold fiber optic through Verizon and was in the telecom industry before we had internet service, but remember talking about it way back in the late 70s, actually, even. And so I've been paying attention to it for quite a while now, and live in Old Orchard Beach. Old Orchard Beach is 25 minutes to Portland and a really small footprint. And so I think it, as far as a location for a municipality or a easy outlay of material and installation for the whole town could be fairly easy done. I also had designed a building that I'd like to build in Old Orchard Beach, actually. And it would be nice to be able to communicate with everybody on a high-speed service so that we can all do business from, you know, our apartments even there in Old Orchard Beach. So it would make a great home office business doing whatever you're doing there.
Exactly, Jay. This is what Susan has studied all over the country. So, Susan, it's people like Jay that have made things happen in their communities, correct?
That's right. Well, and there's a new network about to come online in Millinocket, SanfordNet. City-owned fiber network connecting 88 commercial buildings for a cost of about $2.3 million. Again, connecting to the three-ring binder. And a tremendous story of courage and pluckiness and just, you know, straightforward Maine common sense. People want to be able to work where they live, not have to live where they work. And people in Maine should have the same opportunities as anywhere else. So especially, you know, another book I want to push here, not only my own fiber book, but there's a book called The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming by David Wallace Wells. There are going to be a lot of climate refugees coming to places like rural Maine, and they'll need high, dry, connected places to live. So planning ahead for the future of Maine is going to involve a lot of plucky fiber connectivity in all of those areas.
Well, that's interesting because we do talk a lot about how when we try to attract people to Maine, this is the missing element. So Didn't even think about climate refugees.
Oh, yes. They're coming.
Yeah.
They're coming.
Well, thank you for your call, Jay. And we will take another call now from Roger in Islesboro. Hi, Roger. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. As some of your listeners may know, Islesboro has 1 gigabit fiber to every home and business. In Islesboro, it costs $360 a year. It's almost universal. We have maybe 620 properties connected right now. The town does own the fiber infrastructure, and then the subscribers pay for the service and support. I think some key things that to reinforce what Susan said are that, at least for Islesboro, if the town were to do this, we had to make sure that everybody got the same service. There were no haves and have-nots. We don't have tiered service. Everybody pays the same per year. And we felt that this was essential for the island and for rural economic vitality. We acted because no incumbent was ever going to invest out here. We knew that. It was just a fact. For us, this became a little bit like a municipal water or sewer system. We never made the case, as some towns mistakenly do, to claim that Google would move to your town. We never made that case. All we said was if this was a problem, we had to fix it ourselves. And frankly, the three-ring binder, help from CMP and others, was really critical for us to get this $3.8 million project done. One other point Susan made is that fiber is absolutely the key. We hear about things like 5G, but that requires some real deep thought about the technology of that last mile, and fiber is a much more reliable answer for much of rural Maine, places like Islesboro.
That's a great point, Roger, that everybody's talking about 5G, but Susan, maybe you can explain how they're sort of interconnected. It's not like you can just have 5G without fiber, is that right?
I'm deeply grateful for Roger's call and for Islesboro as an example of this kind of utility-sensible behavior. He's saying actually something even more profound than that 5G as a technology is a very souped-up, fancy wireless idea that will require what's called beamforming, these very, very high-capacity wireless communications transmitted over the air, can't go very far because they're wobbling so quickly. So there will be many, many antennas on a base station trying to focus a beam so that it reaches into the wall of a house. Then you'll need a wire going from your house outside wall inside your house to a hotspot that's a 5G hotspot so that these very advanced wireless communications can even reach you because they just don't travel very far and the communications get kind of shy when they get to walls or windows. They can't go through them. And so even though there's all this hype and talk about 5G, a more resilient solution is actually just to bring the fiber to your home. Mm-hmm. And not rely on the air interface between some base station outside your home that could be interfered with by a tree or, you know, weather, all the kinds of things that routinely happen in Maine. And rather just get that wire as deep as possible and preferably touching homes and businesses.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for the call, Roger. Good work there. And we do need to take another quick break. Were you listening to Maine Calling? We will be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. As do Lamy Wellahan, a Maine family-owned shoe store since 1914, committed to keeping the entire family comfortable, healthy, warm, and dry. And Monson Arts, a nonprofit organization supported by the Libra Foundation, now offering intensive one-week summer workshops. Learn more at monsonarts.org. On the next Speaking in Maine, Canada and Maine, shared past, bright future.
We have a fantastic opportunity to have a strong, vibrant, mutually supportive economic relationship.
Kirsten Hillman is the Chief Trade Negotiator and Deputy Ambassador for Canada. She spoke at the World Affairs Council in Portland about the valuable relationship between Canada and Maine. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public members make public radio possible here in Maine, and we appreciate gifts of support at all levels. The Beacon Society was established to thank and recognize those members whose annual gifts reach $1,200 or more, or $100 a month. If you would like more information about joining the Beacon Society, we thank you for your consideration. Please call Maine Public at 800-884-1717 and speak to Scott Marshaldon. That's 800-884-1717 and Scott Marshaldon. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about transformative potential of fiber optic technology. Joining us today, Susan Crawford, national telecom expert and Harvard Law professor. Her latest book is about fiber. Join our conversation and give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. Susan, we've talked a lot about the possibilities, but there are obstacles to getting fiber into these communities, into people's homes. What are some of the biggest blockades?
Well, as with the electricity story I told, there is tremendous resistance from what we call incumbents. Incumbent just means, you know, the existing companies like Frontier and AT&T and certainly Charter and Comcast. And they're saying the same things that the private electricity companies said in the early part of the 20th century, that it's somehow un-American to think of telecommunications as having a public face, as being part of a public set of utilities. And they will do whatever they can. They've managed to get bills passed in 19 states that make it either impossible or very difficult for towns to do what I'm talking about here. Right after that incredible Wilson Network was built in North Carolina, Spectrum drafted and had signed a bill into law after the 2010 gerrymandering was over, the Republicans got power, in that state that makes it impossible for any city to follow Wilson's lead. So there is tremendous resistance here. And it's almost as if these actors don't want to face competition, which actually makes sense from their standpoint. They're very happy with the status quo. But Americans who understand the state of the situation here in the United States and understand just how much we're paying for lousy service often are able to collect themselves, give their mayor or their governor or their state representatives or their legislators adequate political cover to beat back this incumbent fight? Because that's the basic opposition here. It's political.
It's beyond cost. It's being able to do it at all.
It becomes extremely difficult if you don't have political cover.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm seeing is in state after state, the tide is beginning to turn. And I think Maine is in a particularly good situation with Governor Janet Mills understanding this issue. Senator Angus King has been a great leader for fiber in Maine for years now. And just the sensible nature of Mainers, they get this. And just as you understand that it should be cheap, you understand it should be ubiquitous. And I have hopes that in your state, this will really take off, that Maine will lead the country in this fiber last mile solution making.
That would be great. We'll talk to some more of those sensible Mainers now. Let's go to Carl calling from New Gloucester. Hi, Carl. You're on Maine Calling.
Well, thank you for having me on. From the new year under the Mills administration, I've heard talk about a bond issue to improve internet access in rural areas. But I brought this up to my state senator. I live in New Gloucester, where we have a telco. A gentleman was on just recently. And I don't really have a problem with their service. We get phone and internet, and I wouldn't even have it except for internet. And we pay $50 a month for their basic package, but we get 14 line items for Maine and federal service charges, which add up to a 35.4% tax rate on that $50 basic package. So before we go and issue bonds, you know, I would like the state and federal governments to explain what value we get out of this 35.4% tax. And has there been any thought about a cooperative satellite for rural Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and New York State that might be more cost competitive than running fiber to every home?
Go ahead, Susan.
Well, lots of responses to that. I don't think anybody wants to see rural residents of upstate New York or Maine having a second-class connection. I don't know why you'd want that. And the problem with satellite is that it's so far away. These are 22,000 miles you have to go with those communications. So it ends up having a lot of delay and being quite expensive in comparison to service that you could get over fiber wire. Look, what's going on is Otelco is listing all of those items on the bill in order for you to be irritated at the federal government. Part of that tax is going to subsidize putting in rural networks in very low density areas of the country. It's called the Universal Service Fund. And what I'm talking about is a national approach to this problem that would lower the cost for everyone. Right now, what's happening is that the least dense networks cost is being handed over to the state, because no private companies are willing to serve there, while the private companies are soaking urban areas for as much as they can get away with. And we end up with tremendous disparity in communications quality and an extremely high cost fund for rural areas. By making this a truly universal wholesale service from the government, which is what this book Fiber talks about, the cost ultimately to everyone would be a lot lower. And we pay for bridges, we pay for clean water. The benefits of this would far exceed that kind of infrastructure because, again, our economy is moving only into information services. That's where all the new jobs are going to come from. And making this like a federal highway system or a railroad system that is, in fact, available on a competitive basis to any retail operator, but an operation that the federal government has a big stake in, would make a lot more sense for the country and would keep you from being irritated about your bills for your very rural service.
Okay, and thank you, Carl, for your question. We actually have now on the line Senator Angus King,
Yay.
Independent U.S. Senator from Maine and co-chair of the Senate Broadband Caucus. Thank you, Senator King, for calling in.
Great to be with you, and thanks for talking about this incredibly important topic.
And I understand you've just finished up with your radiation treatments. We all hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. The worst part of the whole experience was having to get up at 5:30 in the morning for 39 days.
But,
I'm done now. No ill effects. Feel great and raring to go.
Okay. Well, we want to talk a little bit more about your involvement with greater access to broadband. What are you focusing on right now?
Well, I think one of the first things we have to focus on is the implementation of the Farm Bill, which passed this year that has, I think it was $380 million in it for rural broadband. And then I heard that the president's budget, which I haven't seen the details, but the indication is that it knocked that money out, proposes not to spend it. That we gotta be sure that that doesn't happen. So that's the kind of thing that we have to work on. The thing about the broadband issue, and I'm sorry I couldn't listen to the earlier part of your program, but there's no single answer. There's no easy, this is what we need. It's 5G or it's fiber or it's satellite or whatever. It's going to be of an answer that depends on the geography and the circumstances of a particular community. But being sure that the federal funds supporting broadband deployment are in the Farm Bill stay intact. Plus, one of the things I'm doing is being real annoying about any infrastructure bill that we do has to include broadband. It can't be just highways, railroads, bridges, ports. Broadband is the key infrastructure of the 21st century. So those are a couple of things that I'm paying attention to.
Well, great. And we talked earlier about how the U.S. is really behind other countries like China and some of the northern European countries, and the fact that sort of that competitiveness and national pride doesn't seem to be driving decision-making at the federal level. Does that matter that we're behind?
It does matter. It matters tremendously, and it matters region to region. I mean, one of the great – we have pretty good broadband service in most of the urban areas, but rural areas, it's very spotty, and it's a real impediment, not only for business in a rural area, but for people just plain living there. Young people aren't going to want to live in a community where they can't have good high-speed access. So, yes, it's a national competitive issue. It's a competitive issue for Maine, and it's a competitive issue for particularly the rural areas. And that's why Shelley Capito and I and a couple of others started this broadband caucus, because I don't think there's the sense of urgency that there ought to be.
And I'm just wondering, with regulatory hurdles to getting fiber, are those very difficult to remove for states to even have any sort of local fiber networks?
Well, of course, in Maine, we're really fortunate in that, remember the stimulus package in the mm-hmm. first year or so of the Obama administration. Part of that in Maine was spent on building a really good fiber network throughout the state. It's called the three-ring binder, and think of it as the interstate in a big circle that goes through a lot of Maine. The problem is connecting the middle mile and the last mile. In other words, it's like having the interstate go by your town with no off-ramps. And I don't think the regulatory hurdles are as much of the problem as the difficulty is the financial case for connecting rural communities, because the houses are further apart. It's the same reason in the 30s that it took federal action under President Roosevelt for rural electrification, because the cities were all electrified, the farms weren't, because the farms were far apart and you had to build the poles and the wires. We need a similar kind of effort now, I think, to be sure rural America isn't left out of what amounts to the economy of the 21st century.
Well, thank you for your work on this, Senator King, and thank you for taking the time to call in today. Senator Angus King is the independent U.S. Senator from Maine. He co-chairs the Senate Broadband Caucus. And Susan, you have mentioned before that Senator King is one of the national leaders on these issues.
Absolutely. His depth of understanding and his sensible good judgment on this have really been models for the country. And I'm hoping that his discussion of this issue becomes more just more known around the country. I'm not sure that people outside of Maine understand how deeply he is a leader.
Great. We'll squeeze in a couple more questions before I need to wrap up. There's an email that says, what are the opportunities for private investment? Is the availability or potential availability of government funding a possible disincentive to private investors, i.e., why chip in unless and or until you can piggyback on free or cheap money?
Actually, I see the two things as very complementary. When a public investment is intelligently installed, as I think Senator King wants it to be, that the regulatory ideal here is that that wholesale network or that basic connectivity then will inspire private investment to actually sell the retail service on part of it. Because the whole point is that we need to unleash the private marketplace to do its part in providing communication services. For me, that's at the retail level, actually serving customers, and getting that public investment in the ground first is going to make it possible for that private market to emerge. The risk with the Trump infrastructure bill is that it'll ultimately be a back doorway to essentially privatizing public assets while possibly generating little private investment. A better route, frankly, would be straight ahead public investment in this basic utility that then lets the private marketplace come in on top of it.
Okay, we're getting calls and questions from people all over the state who either want to bring fiber to their communities or are working on it, which is great to hear. I just wanted to ask you one more question, Susan, about how hopeful you are that we will reach this future of fiber for our country.
Look, we used to do great things. We saved the world from tyranny. I don't know if you remember that. We built the federal highway system. We built the Transcontinental Railroad. We built a canal spanning east to west. I mean, it's extraordinary what we're capable of. What we're missing right now is the sense of crisis and political leadership. Crisis is certainly present on the ground. Lots of people in Maine understand how profound and human this issue is. What we need now is the political leadership that viscerally understands this and takes it on, just the way that FDR took on electricity. Without that, I'm afraid we'll languish. And people in South Korea told me that coming to the U.S. is like taking a rural vacation for them.
Oh, that's enlightening. Well, Susan, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today. Susan Crawford is a national telecom expert and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Her latest book is Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow on the show, our automotive experts will return to talk about the latest news in the world of cars, trucks, and SUVs. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.